The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I hope you had an enjoyable 4th of July weekend, those of you who reside in the United States, that is. If you don't reside in the United States, I hope you had an enjoyable weekend wherever you are. I want you to know I still... whether you appreciate this or not, but I still haven't gotten to the end of my interest in that Wolfsburg camp that I talked about last week, the one that Dr. Wilhelm Christman was interned in after the war. I keep finding out more about it. There are a couple of websites I've been looking at, and I just wanted to tell you a little bit before I bring on my esteemed guest about what kind of a camp it was when it was under the Germans as a camp for British and other prisoners of war. The camp existed from 1941 to 1945, and it was called Stalag 18A. There were work camps attached to it called, of course, Arbeitskommandos, and there were quite a lot of prisoners there all in all, but at the camp itself, it was divided into sections, and the largest section was the British and Commonwealth prisoners. And that was about 300 men in there. So that's nothing like the number of men that were in there when the Austrians were in there. But I can't say this is what it said on there. And the British was a little bit larger. But then there were the other sections. There was a French section. There was an Italian section, a Russian section, and a Polish section. There are several diagrams on the internet of it. They're all just a little bit different, but they show all the facilities that were there. And it's quite interesting. The British section had its own hospital and surgery. It had a detention area, and it had a theater, and they put on quite elaborate plays there. The British prisoners were the ones who were the most active in the camp, I would say, probably. And next to the British section, there was, right outside the fence there, but it was accessible through a little, you'd go through, it looked like a little opening, and then there was another opening to the outside. I imagine it might have been open sometimes and closed sometimes, but there were French and English workshops. There was a store, and there was a very large clothing store in addition to that, and there was a Red Cross parcel store, and then a tailors and boot repair building. And now the French section was next to the British, and it also had its own hospital and surgery, and there was a large prisoner's kitchen right behind that. That would have been, I suppose, for the whole camp. And between the British and French sections, there was a large double sport field and a cinema. And there was a delousing building there. And also a pretty good size kind of complex, of which is called the Dentist and Medical Report section with medical care buildings. And between the French and Soviet sections, there was a British and Italian quarantine area. Then there was an Italian section that had its own hospital, some hospital buildings, and a Russian section had its own hospital buildings, or medical care buildings. I don't know if you'd call them hospitals, but they were medical buildings. And then they called this Polish section special for some reason. And it doesn't show any medical facilities in that section, but I suppose it was quite a bit smaller, and probably they went to the general, the other one I already mentioned, that was for everybody, the dental and medical report section. So it's pretty interesting, all that they had there, much of which had been removed. Obviously, they didn't have it or use it anymore when the Austrians were in there. But the other thing is that there was some bombing that took place there, so a lot of things may have been destroyed in 1945. on another website, it shows quite a few pictures. And there are tons of pictures on this other website. If you just Google Stalag 18A, you will find these sites, I'm sure. And they lots of pictures showing all these POWs, and they look very healthy, very muscular. They're all without their shirts. They're wearing their shorts and their little T-shirts or no shirts and stuff a lot, and their sandals, and they look, they certainly, you can't say they're not well-fed because they look like they're thriving. And there's one of the pictures is of Commandant Steiner, which shows this, German high-level officer who's the commandant of the camp, and he's with all the men. They're all smiling and laughing, and he's talking to one of them. And the comment there says that Commandant Steiner was a humane officer, very well liked by the men. So this is the kind of atmosphere that was there. It certainly was not a terrible place ever. Most everybody went home from there eventually. Not very many people died. More died in the Russian camp, but that was partly the way the Russian government treated their POWs. They didn't do anything for them. Well, I wanted to let you know that because I still think it's very important to make comparisons between what supposedly they say about what happened in the camps that the Germans ran, and yet the camps of the Allies were just fine. So now I want to take the opportunity to welcome Friedrich Paul Berg to my program today. Fritz, thank you for waiting, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Carolyn. Happy 4th of July, and let me give a little bit background about myself. I'm an engineer by education, and when I started studying these Holocaust claims 30 years ago, my focus was on the gas chambers, and gradually I became convinced, and I think I've convinced a number of people with some success, that all of the gas chamber claims are absolute rubbish. Nobody was killed with gas chambers. And some people have recognized that that is true. No, there were no gassings of Jews or anybody else. But now what is emerging, I think, among some of the revisionists is a recognition of the real Holocaust that was occurring. And there was a Holocaust. Thousands and thousands of Jews were killed, mostly by disease, indirectly, but many were also murdered by the Allied air campaign. And this is a part of the story which is enormously important, but has generally been ignored until rather recently. Since 2000, we've had a number of books about the Allied air campaign against German civilians, and the picture that emerges is really a horrible, horrible picture. And it is a picture which blames America and Britain for committing far worse atrocities than anything the Germans are even accused of. Nearly everything that Americans believe is overwhelming evidence or proof of Nazi genocidal barbarism is actually evidence of Anglo-American barbarism. The evidence that Americans are most taken in by are photographs of sick and dead people in the concentration camps. The overwhelming numbers of healthy survivors, and you just mentioned the fact that there were lots of survivors in this camp that you were just talking about, those pictures are rarely shown. Most people assume that everybody in the camps was either sick or dying, and that's just not true at all. There were a number of outbreaks of typhus and other diseases in the camps. And the real mass murderers of many tens of thousands of Jews were not the Nazis or the SS, but the Western Allies themselves as they bombed and strafed vast numbers of people in these columns of civilians trekking west to escape the Russian army. The refugees and the evacuees, including Jews, were fleeing to the west to find safety and protection from people that they thought were decent, civilized, good, nice people, but they found something else instead. The Allied intentions with the air campaign of bombing and strafing was not to kill Jews. It was only to kill Germans. But who could separate them? Who could tell the difference between Jews on a so-called death march or on a train, even with open flat cars, or Germans or Eastern Europeans? How could anybody tell the difference, even if they wanted to? So what to do? Kill them all. That was basically the guideline that many of these Anglo-American pilots were going by. If they saw dots on the road down below, shoot them if you possibly can, especially if they're civilians, because the civilians didn't shoot back.
Fritz, isn't that a war crime? They had even their fighter planes going around flying low and
exactly.
Shooting at these columns of people.
Well, there's a very famous fighter pilot, Chuck Yeager, who was the man who broke the sound barrier.
Yeah, my namesake.
Oh, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
The relative.
No relative, though.
Okay. Well, in his book, Yeager, which was a very popular book, must have come out about 20 years ago, he actually talked about how he was ordered to just kill German civilians. And among the people he murdered were farmers plowing their potato fields. You know, and a big potato field that has no trees on it, and it's a wide open space, and a farmer might be picking weeds between his potato rows, and suddenly a P-51 appears with eight blazing 50 caliber machine guns. So what's the poor guy's chances of survival? They're not too good. And Chuck Yeager admitted that that was a war crime, but if you're on the winning side, you'll get away with it. And that's what happened.
I suspect that the Jews who are telling all their stories ever since the end of the war, and some of them have just started recently, a lot of them, they all say that, oh, bombing was going on, but none of us were hurt, as though these allies were avoiding hurting them. They say, I don't believe that. I think that's just another one of their fabrications that they say, because they don't want to accuse the allies of any of the deaths of Jews, as exactly what you're pointing out right now, to make sure that, well, it's only Germans who are killing them.
Well, occasionally you do get some recognition of the fact that the bombing and strafing of trains and groups where Jews were walking or marching to the west were strafed also. Occasionally you get that, but it's very hard to kind of put these all together, because the Jews, of course, have a vested interest in blaming the Germans for everything. But the term death march is used to describe these treks of Jews, and especially Jews from places like Auschwitz. In a sense, they were death marches, but it was not because the Germans were simply trying to march these people to death to kill them out of exhaustion or out of any other way. They were, in a sense, death marches because the Jews and others were being strafed to death by any American and British planes that might happen to be in the area. Now, what is very important to realize, and I learned this gradually, and yet I learned it in some dramatic ways, the American and British pilots were basically very cowardly, despicable creatures, as far as I'm concerned. It's a very harsh thing to say, but it's valid and it's true. If you bomb or try to strafe a military target where you see, let's say, a company of German soldiers, that's dangerous, because those guys have high-speed machine guns, they have accurate rifles. If you try to strafe some of those guys, there's a good chance they're going to shoot back, and they may get real lucky and hit your P-51 and knock out some oil lines and knock the plane down. But if you strafe civilians, people, you know, with carts, with clothing, and whatever personal possessions they have, you're pretty safe, because they're not going to shoot back. And so many of these P-51 pilots and other pilots, they just went to town. They went on a murdering spree by murdering civilians on these long roads from the east. And these were desperate people. They could probably barely walk in many cases. They were hungry, cold, These were miserable, miserable conditions that these people were traveling under, and they were mowed down again and again and again. Even in trains coming from the east, the train would be preferably blocked. The locomotive would be knocked out, and this is explained even in some of the combat instruction films from the U.S. Army. You first try to knock out the locomotive, and then you can casually go back and forth and strafing all the railroad cars in that particular train. And if there are civilians or soldiers or anybody on those railroad cars, well, that's just tough luck. Most of them, or many of them, will certainly get killed from the 50 caliber machine gun fire.
Well, a lot of German military got killed in those so-called death marches.
But the Germans tend to shoot back. German military tend to shoot back.
Yeah, but I mean those guards and stuff who were overseeing those people. And I think that you have mentioned, I don't know if it was you, but they're pictured as sadistic monsters who were, like you say, trying to hope they die on the march or something. Well, they were really risking their own lives to bring those people to another place. Of course, they were ordered to do so. You know, and a lot of them were killed or died, suffered things on those marches. It wasn't just the prisoners.
Well, they weren't even prisoners. By and large, these people in these treks, including the Jews, were, you know, going along of their own free will. The vast majority of so-called Auschwitz survivors in January of 1945 chose willingly to go west with the retreating Germans. They weren't forced to go west.
Yeah, I just call them prisoners because that's what they're officially.
Well,
they're officially
but
I know what you mean.
One should explain that. And let me give you an example of the kind of information that's coming to light now about that. Even a very well-known Jewish historian, I'm trying to find the portion here in my website, which I'm looking at, an Israeli Holocaust historian, Israel Gutman, said that the Jewish prisoners actually joined the march voluntarily. And here is the testimony from Gutman's book, as it was given by Gilad Atzmon, and I'm quoting here. One of my friends and relatives in the camp came to me on the night of the evacuation and offered a common hiding place somewhere on the way from the camp to the factory. The intention was to leave the camp with one of the convoys and to escape near the gate. Using the darkness, we thought to go a little far from the camp. The temptation was very strong, but yet, after I considered it all, I then decided to join the march with all the other inmates and to share their fate. And Gilad Atzmon, in response to that, he says, I am puzzled here. If the Nazis were in a death factory in Auschwitz-Birkenau, why would the Jewish prisoners join them at the end of the war? Why didn't the Jews wait for their red liberators? And there's no answer to that that's consistent with the Holocaust story. The vast majority of Jews from Auschwitz and other camps went west voluntarily with the Germans because they knew the Germans were not out to murder them.
Yeah, you've talked about that a lot, and I wanted to bring that up, about how the Jews were treated. In fact, you've gone so far to say, and I really commend you for that, because it's kind of like a big no-no, you know, but it needs to be start breaking through, that the Jews were taken care of by the Germans through all this wartime.
In Bergen-Belsen, which is sort of the epitome of the horrible camps, the Germans were feeding their inmates there every day. Now, they weren't getting rich four-square meals, balanced diet. They were getting things like oatmeal and bread and simple gruel and simple food, because that's all the Germans had. The Germans themselves were starving. Everybody was starving in Germany. That had been the strategy of the British in particular from the first day of the war, to starve the Germans. And by the end of the war, they had been very successful in starving everybody in Germany. Prisoners in the camps at least got supplements from the Red Cross. They got all kinds of nice goodies sometimes with their Red Cross packages, including chocolate. But Germans actually fed these people, in addition to that, with basically regular German food that was minimal, but it was still a burden on the Germans. When the Germans themselves were starving, they were still sharing that limited supply of food with the Jews and other people in the concentration camps. That makes no sense whatsoever if you're simply trying to kill people. Why bother feeding them at all when there was such a premium on food, when you yourself and your own family are near starvation? And that is, of course, all covered up in the Holocaust propaganda. The fact is the Jews were treated very, very well. They really don't have anything to complain about as far as their treatment under the Nazis. But, of course, when the war was over, none of them wanted to say that. That was not the message that the Allies wanted to hear. So why should the Jews burden anybody?
Well, that was not the message the Jews wanted to hear either, because they were trying to create Israel. So,
Well, that too.
I would have to say at this moment I agree that this whole Holocaust was really built up for the purpose of Israel and is being kept going for the purpose of Israel and what they're doing there and what they want to continue to do there. And that really is what it's all about. What do you say to that?
Yeah, but the purpose was also to destroy the Germans and to destroy Germany forever. That was all.
Well, Israel wants to use Germany for its slaves, sort of. So they keep their standing on Germany's neck.
I think they wanted to totally destroy Germany. And the only reason it didn't happen was because after World War II, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was no longer president. Harry Truman was president instead. And he wasn't very sympathetic to Stalin and to communism, whereas Roosevelt certainly was. And so things did change very much within a few years after the war. But the Germans were still starved deliberately by the United States and Britain for several years after World War II. But what happened, eventually America got scared. America suddenly realized, these Russians are out to get us too. Mm-hmm. And so a certain amount of common sense did emerge in American military thinking, and Americans eventually decided that it might be real nice to have the Germans fight for us again against the Russians. And that was what accounted for the change after 1947. So there are lots of things that were involved here. There was this fanatical genocidal hatred of Germany from the United States and Britain, especially at the leadership, and that did sort of turn around after 1947, when it became perfectly clear that the Soviet Union was no friend of the United States, that the Soviet Union was out to really conquer the entire world, to save the world, one might even say, for communism and for the great socialist revolution.
Yes. Many of them did want the absolute destruction of Germany during and right after the war. But then once things changed, and as you say, the Soviet Union became the threat, then they had to see it differently. And since then, it's been pretty much as a way of keeping Israel going.
Well, that too. But they want to keep the Germans under control, even if they don't
want to
kill them outright.
Well, why should they kill them now when they're such a gift horse, you know, for them? Do everything for them. Well, we will come back after the break and talk about a few other things. And so stick with us, friends.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR. ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Iran is remembering the victims of a tragic plane disaster that took place 22 years ago. An Iranian airliner with 290 people on board was shot down by a U.S. Navy ship, apparently by mistake. Washington has yet to apologize for the incident. You may find some of the images in Jihan Hafiz's report disturbing.
As U.S. President Barack Obama issues new sanctions against Iran, he offers these words of encouragement to the Iranian people.
In Iran and around the world, the United States of America will continue to stand with those who seek justice and progress and the human rights and dignity of all people.
22 years ago, 290 Iranian civilians were killed by an American Navy ship, an incident the U.S. has refused to apologize for.
Oh, shit! We had him gone. That was a shit on!
At the height of the Iran-Iraq war, the USS Vincennes in the Strait of Hormuz blew up Iranian airliner 655, killing all 290 citizens on board, including nearly 70 children. At the time of the deadly incident, the U.S. Navy said it was a case of mistaken identity and believed the plane to be an F-14 fighter jet, the same ones the U.S. sold to the Shah of Iran just 10 years before.
The bold-faced lies about, you know, the plane was descending, it was approaching an altitude where it was prepared to attack us. If it was flying at that low of an altitude, it would clearly have been seen for what it was. Not an F-14.
Navid, an Iranian-American, refers back to the initial investigation.
It absolutely was a cover-up, and even the cover-up itself was denied. Not only just the fact that a mistake happened, the fact that a cover-up happened to cover up the mistake was also denied.
Like millions of Iranians around the world, Navid will mark July 3rd as a day of mourning.
I believe that given the operating environment, Captain Rogers acted reasonably and did what his nation expected of him, in the defense of his ship and crew.
The crew of the USS Vincennes was later awarded combat action medals, and the captain of the ship was awarded the Legion of Merit. No one from the USS Vincennes was ever penalized for taking down the Airbus.
The cover-up, the medals, it just speaks to a larger mentality that is at play here, which is, not only can we do no wrong, but all of our actions are inherently right.
The U.S. later settled the case with the Iranians at $131 million, compared to the near $3 billion Libya paid the United States for their Lockerbie bombing.
Hi, I was calling to get general comments about an incident that took place 22 years ago. Call the State Department? So now we're on the phone with the State Department, and they say we have to call the DOD back to get a response. The DOD had originally sent us over to the Navy to the State Department. Now the State Department is sending us back to the Department of Defense.
The fact that George Bush said that, for example, I will never apologize for the U.S. no matter what the facts are, it's not even a matter of apologizing for the U.S., it's just a matter of admitting a simple wrongdoing.
And so, as the U.S. gears up to celebrate their Independence Day on the 4th of July, the Islamic Republic of Iran will be mourning 22 years since the American Navy killed nearly 300 of their people. Jahan Hafiz, RT, Washington, D.C.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and we have been joined by a second guest I will introduce in a moment, but I want to tell you Mr. Berg's website, which is www.nazigassings.com, and I've recommended his website several times, and it's an excellent site for lots of information. So don't forget to go and check that out, www.nazigassings, that's plural with an S, .com. Well, Fritz, we were talking about the concentration camps, and now I want to move over to a story about Demjanjuk, and not too much about him, actually, but about a former Justice Department official that has made some comments, and then we'll go and talk about our dear, one of our favorite subjects here on Heretics Hour, which is Elie Wiesel. And we have been joined by Eric Hunt, and I want to welcome you, Eric. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi. Eric Hunt has also a wonderful website called erichunt.com, and when you go there, you'll understand what he's been doing. I think he's pretty famous, a young man, and he hasn't been on the radio, any radio programs that I know of, so this may be a first. Is that right, Eric?
Yeah, I'm definitely happy to be here because both you and Fritz as well have been great supporters of mine since October when I decided to sort of turn the tables on these liars and I sued a woman named Irene Zisblatt. I believe you've spoken about her on this program, but she's a woman who's written her memoirs and claims to have repeatedly defecated and swallowed her mother's prized diamonds while in Auschwitz and other camps. And I read her autobiography. I saw that it was a work of fiction and worked to debunk it. And I just decided to sue her. And I think it's a good tactic that is underused by our side, which is so used to being on the defensive.
I was introduced to Irene Zisblatt's story through you and your website, and I got very involved in it myself, but I haven't really talked about it on this program. And so after I got acquainted with all of that and got deeply into it, I actually went on as a guest on this network with Dr. Tom Sunick, and I talked quite a bit about you and your lawsuit and how we should go, we should take legal action against these people and so on his program. The thing is, it's difficult. You know, it presents many, many difficulties, but I agree with you that that is what we should do, but how to do it is another
matter.
Well,
the two reasons I think it's a good tactic is because the sued party is required to respond in writing by law. I think that's the number one reason to do it. For instance, we can get information about Elie Wiesel just by suing him. He'd have to respond in writing within 30 days. Another reason is because of just the mainstream press a lawsuit generates, so that we're not just in the same loop on the internet. We're out in the real world, and I'm sure my lawsuit against Zisblatt has changed some minds of people who weren't even interested or involved in the Holocaust debate.
Well, Fritz seems to think that. What do you think are the chances of making any headway in the courts, Fritz?
I don't think the chances are too good, but it's an important tactic in order to generate evidence and information.
Oh, yes.
The trial, for example, of Ernst Sundel in Canada really didn't change anything in a good way as far as Canadian law or the situation for revisionists in Canada, but the evidence generated by Ernst Sundel and his team of lawyers and supporters was just fantastic. And I think the same thing is happening already in connection with Elie Wiesel and this battle that Eric initiated years ago, how many years ago is it now? 3 years ago, by actually confronting Elie Wiesel in San Francisco.
Yes, but he paid a terrible price for it.
Eric paid a terrible price, but the evidence that's emerging as a result of Eric and his courage and his determination will, I think, undermine the entire Holocaust story. Elie Wiesel personifies the Holocaust entirely with his being, with everything about him. He looks like he just got out of Auschwitz yesterday. He physically personifies the Holocaust legend. And when we show that this guy is just a scurrilous liar who deserves no sympathy, he was not a worker at the camp there for making synthetic fuel. It's inconceivable that the guy ever lifted a piece of pipe. And yet, that is a major part of his story. The guy is just one of the most outrageous and scurrilous liars in all of human history. This is a guy who goes to the Davos World Economic Forum almost every year, and he hobnobs with the most influential people in the world as if he was on a par with them. And he is on a par with them, I suppose. So when we undermine Elie Wiesel, we've gone a long way to undermining the entire Holocaust story, and we should do that.
Well, this is very nice because, as you know, I'm involved in putting together this website, and it's been announced now in an article in Bradley Smith's little newspaper thing he puts out every month. And it's under the CODO banner. And I think we have quite a good program, lot of good ideas for it, and I think it's going to accomplish a lot. But this really brings me what you just said, Fritz, about Ellie hobnobbing with all the bigwigs, to this story that I just put on my website, and it is that he is campaigning now in a big way to free Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who is that Yukos founder who has been a prisoner in Russia. He was convicted of 6 or 8 years. He's served 4 or something, and they're trying to get him out. And now here's exactly how they do this. You know, I am convinced, I have no doubt, that Ellie has a PR firm working on his behalf. And these things that we see in the newspaper, these news items on him, are put together and written by them and sent out as releases to the newspapers and all the media outlets. And they do a little this or that, change it a little bit, not much. And this one is written in a way to make it appear that he was at this luncheon at the White House with Medvedev and Obama, or he hosted a luncheon there, because the story starts out that he's launching, and of course his name is always preceded by Nobel Peace Laureate. And you know, they worked hard to get him that. And ever since then, he's able to put that in front of his name, Nobel Peace Laureate. Elie Wiesel is launching a global campaign to free Khodorkovsky, whom he calls a political prisoner. All right, the next paragraph. Wiesel and his wife Marion hosted a lunch. And then it goes on to say, on the eve of President Medvedev's meeting with U.S. President Barack Obama at the White House on Thursday to spotlight the plight of... And it goes on to say about what they did. And then it says, after that, now, we don't know where this lunch is, but after lunch comes the White House, you know. And then after that, they say, well, the Peace Prize winner, author, and Holocaust survivor invited 30 prominent Americans to brainstorm how to bring pressure on Medvedev. And it's leaving the impression that somehow Elie Wiesel is involved in a lunch at the White House and involved with these heads of state. I mean, if you read it carefully, if you can read, you know that that's not the truth. But if people just start out reading and get a first impression, they don't continue. They go on to the next story, and they're left with that. I really think this is all done purposefully. And, of course, Wiesel, his final thing is that Khodorkovsky is a political prisoner, and he was never legally convicted. And so he thinks he should be freed. And what about all of these political that we were just talking about? Eric himself and Ernst Sundel and all the others, they're all political prisoners. And yet he's campaigning all over the world, Wiesel, to make Holocaust denial a crime everywhere. Therefore, we'd have all these political prisoners in there who are not really, you know, what are they really guilty of? So, as I know you both agree, it's just the incredible lies and hypocrisy of it all is really beyond belief.
Well, it's very Jewish. You know, what we're seeing is a demonstration of Jewish power. And Obama knows he has to pander to the Jewish vote and to the Jewish community in order to have any chance of Democratic Party success in the coming elections. We may be at war with Iran in order to help secure a victory for the Democratic Party in November. It all goes down to Jewish power and influence. And it underlines or it illustrates exactly why Hitler and Nazi Germany tried to expel the Jews from Germany, and rightly so. This was something that was absolutely necessary for Germany, and it may be absolutely necessary for America if we ever hope to have a free and independent country ever again. We don't have one now. I mean, right now we're fighting 2 wars, getting ready to fight a 3rd war, basically to make Israel more secure than it already is. I mean, there's no real danger to Israel right now, but there is a remote possibility of a danger, and therefore Americans are dying and killing people every day. And it's just no end in sight. So we have a real Jewish problem here in the United States, and how that's going to be solved is a mystery. I mean, I don't have any definitive answers, but the Elie Wiesel phenomenon is only a illustration of how tough this problem is. Here is a guy who's just an out-and-out liar, and he's gotten the highest awards. He's treated as if he were a Mother Teresa of the Holocaust.
In previous programs, I think Carolyn's mentioned it, but I think it's worth mentioning again. I've found archival photographs of Elie Wiesel's left arm, where he claims his tattoo is, and we have the video, I believe it's from the 80s or 90s, Elie Wiesel produced. It's called Elie Wiesel Goes Home.
Yeah, try to remember to call him Elie Wiesel.
I'm sorry. Weasel.
Okay.
And there's no sign of a tattoo anywhere on his arm, faded or otherwise. You could see other survivors with, it's clear in the lowest resolution photographs that they have a tattoo on their left arm, forearm. I've seen archival photographs in his memoirs, for instance. He's standing next to an Israeli military officer. This is back in the 60s or maybe even the 50s. There's no sign of a tattoo, and there's a Holocaust survivor. His name's Miklos Gruner. And Miklos Gruner claims that Elie Wiesel is an imposter, that he doesn't have a tattoo, and he has some documents which point to that.
I've talked about that, Eric. I don't want to interrupt here, but really okay, I've talked about that in depth on this program. And I will just say right now I'm checking out the latest story that is coming out on what we're doing about this is at www.quoto.com/newsletter/sr/online or just /sr_173.pdf. Well, it's if you just go to quoto.com and then look for where it says the Smith's Report newsletter and click on there because it's a PDF, but you can read it all online, and it's the second article. It's on page 3. Starts on page 3. It's 3 pages that will inform everyone about what the background of all of this and also talk about that famous Buchenwald photograph, but they did forget to put the photograph in, and the website that's coming up, and all of this information is going to be on, and we are wanting people to get involved in every way that's possible, you know, whatever way they think they can get involved, whatever they think they can do, and we want to bring this to a huge public awareness of this very fact that you were saying, Eric, that he doesn't have a tattoo and he refuses to ever show his arm. So that's the kind of the focus of the website. It's going to be, you know, where's the tattoo, and then of course everything else is going to be on there. Also,
that's incredible and something that no one's ever really touched upon, that the world's most famous Holocaust promoter has never shown his tattoo.
With kid gloves, you know, whatever.
Oh,
he says, oh, I don't want to exhibit my body. Oh, well, of course he doesn't. Oh, we wouldn't ask him. How rude. You know, so you have to be rude if you if you want to get information out there sometimes, don't you?
Exactly. Definitely. And as far as Wiesel, the poses that he keeps, he's known for these poses as if he's continuing, he's just suffering constantly, just holding his head with one arm. And that's funny that I think earlier you mentioned his sisters, and he doesn't like talking about them. Apparently, you know, if he is Elie Wiesel as he says he is, his sisters both survived Dachau, and Dachau, wow, that's got the reputation as possibly, easily one of the worst camps, especially in night. He doesn't mention that they survived. That's something.
Night condemns him right there. You know, I have to admit,
absolutely,
I'm going to admit right here publicly on the air that I have never read that book, and when I think about reading it, I get kind of sick. I don't think I could stand it, but I might. Do it. I should. But I know a lot of what's in it. You can read it real quick.
You can read it. You can read it in an hour, and then it'll ruin your whole day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he doesn't say anything accurate in there, does he? I mean, nothing. Nothing is accurate.
The basic outline is, I mean, if he is actually was in the camps, compared to this, but it might be true that he was in a camp. But other than that, he talks about flaming pits of fire, two separate ones. This is how efficient the Germans were. They had two separate flaming pits, one for the adults and one for the babies.
Yeah, I'm not saying he was not in a camp. I'm not saying he wasn't deported. I'm not saying he wasn't moved around in that system for period of time. But I don't think it was where he says he was. And just like Zisblatt was in places, but she says she was somewhere else. So why do they do that?
Yeah.
I'm asking, why do they do that? Why don't they tell what they really did? Why do they make things up?
Yeah, I was incredibly shocked that Zisblatt lied about which camp she was in. I mean, what difference if it's another camp? I think she just wanted to be in camps that had worse reputations.
Ellie Wiesel wants to be in Auschwitz. But that just goes to show that all they're doing is they're making up anything in order to effect.
Yeah.
That just shows that they have no intention of being truthful.
Also, in connection with Zisblatt, Eric found that a story Zisblatt had put out that she had been the victim of experimentation turned out to be quite bogus, at least based on the evidence that she apparently presented, claiming that or insisting that she had some evidence of experimentation. It turned out the evidence was merely the diagnosis of a doctor showing that Zisblatt had some tuberculosis inflammations on her skin, some lumps.
Actually, it turns out
Zisblatt. Yeah.
But this is actually two people that this turned out to be. It actually the documents that they claimed was proof of that they were experimented on in sadistic experiments actually turned out to be the results of a stool sample, and they were both negative. Mm-hmm. And it's hilarious in Zisblatt's instance, because she claimed to have defecated diamonds. I guess the Nazis didn't find any diamonds in that stool sample. but in regards to the stool sample issue, I guess we're going in the same path. So Zisblatt's the star of the Steven Spielberg documentary, The Last Days. And it won the Academy Award in 1999, Best Documentary. And practically everything she says in it is a lie, but I knew for quite some time that basically everything in that movie was a lie. So recently I found another document featured in the film. This, quote, survivor, Renee Firestone, actually confronts a living Nazi doctor at Auschwitz who was acquitted, I believe, at Nuremberg. And she confronts him with these documents that she claims her sister died of sadistic experiments, and they show extreme close-ups of the document and melodramatic music, violins, and you're led to believe that this doctor, he's a living Mengele. He got away from justice because he's denying. He says, this document's normal. There's nothing wrong here. This is during the normal period. You were there. Don't you understand? That's what he says to the woman. And every review just slams his name's Dr. Monk, and as an evil, evil person. And actually Fritz Bergen. We got the actual documents, and he helped me translate part of them. And this also turned out to be a stool sample.
And they still tell people they were doing these stool samples because these were people in quarantine, which most of these Hungarian Jews, they came, they were in quarantine for a couple of months, and they were to make sure they didn't have any diseases. So then they take these stool samples every so often to see how, you know, what was in there. And then once they were okay, they sent them to other camps.
Let me interject, if I may, Carolyn. The point is that this evidence that they present is not at all evidence of anything atrocious. What it is evidence of the German measures to keep these people alive.
You know, absolutely.
It's the total opposite of what mm-hmm. it's used for. It's used to make a tremendous horror story when in reality this evidence, this medical evidence, such as it is evidence of the exact opposite. It is evidence of the humane, life-preserving efforts of these German doctors, of the SS, of the administration of Auschwitz. It, in reality, totally undermines the Holocaust claims. Why would one give a damn about whether or not these people had diseases if all you want to do was kill them to begin with?
Well, not only that, not only in the so-called death camps, but in the German camps, now, you know, they claim at Buchenwald, what was I just reading recently, they claim at Buchenwald, this horrible woman who's blogging on that, that the, all these thousands of Jews died at Buchenwald from starvation, overwork, and disease, as if they were making them diseased on purpose. You know, as that the idea was to make them die of disease.
Right.
Which is, like you say, is entirely opposite, and it also brings us back to what we were talking about in the first half, that the Jews were being taken care of. You know, I read recently that Himmler, where did I get this? Himmler was planning a big hospital at Birkenau, big hospital.
Wow.
They had plans, you know, for the war to go on, and therefore they needed all these people. They wanted to keep them healthy. You know, they didn't want them to die. They didn't want them to die.
Perfect.
They were their workers.
The perfect example of that is that Elie Wiesel supposedly had his foot operated on to heal it. So, I mean, if it was to the death camp, just send them to the, quote, gas chambers, but of course they didn't exist.
And they employed Jewish doctors to take care of the Jewish patients. You know, it wasn't just all Nazi fiends like Mengele supposedly was. They used Jewish doctors to care for Jews as well. So the whole nature of what was really going on is just radically different. It's not just a little bit different. It's not just denied.
Yeah.
The Germans actually treated these people extremely well, and the Jews, once again, as I said before, have absolutely nothing to complain about. Well, that's why the vast majority of Jews from Auschwitz and other camps to the east, including the Jews in Spielberg's story, Schindler's List, they went west. They went with the Germans, the retreating Germans, and the SS. They preferred to be with them than to be liberated by the Russians or anybody else. These people were getting paid for their work, and I'm sure they were getting paid very well. I don't know exactly how much they were being paid, but I'm quite sure all of these Jews who were working in Germany, making V2 rockets or whatever, they were getting paid for their work and getting paid very well. I suspect, based on the research of a man named Witch, who did a lot of research on this subject, that the Jews were getting paid exactly the same wages as German workers for the same work in Germany. And they were piling up bundles of money, substantial bank accounts, for their work either in Auschwitz or in other places. When they were working on assembling and building V2 rockets, these were highly skilled jobs. These were not jobs that some flunky from a ghetto can do right away. The amount of training for these people had to be very substantial. Weeks and months had to be expended just to train people to do the basic work that was involved in building aerospace equipment, jet planes. The most advanced military technology in the world was being built by Jews to a great extent. And these were not people that you wanted to kill or to starve unnecessarily. They were being starved at the end of the war, but that was because of the Allies, not because of the Germans.
And then, as we were talking about the camps and the doctors, the Jewish doctors in the camp, it's common in concentration camps that you take the talented and the trained people from among those inmates, and you put them to work at the things that they're good at, you know. So you find doctors, you find teachers, you find other kinds of people there. Well, the medical people were probably the most important. But this is common, and they don't like to talk about that either.
I'm trying to compile a documentary just basically debunking the entirety of Steven Spielberg's film, The Last Days. You can check out my work on erichunt.net or the CODO forums. And basically, I'm looking for donations to help me complete various projects that I'm working on. Thank you.
Well, where can people find where they can donate?
I just have a button at the top of my site that you can...
You want to go to erichunt.net, right?
Yeah, I think that would be best, yes.
Okay, remember that, friends, those two websites.
I hope everybody supports Eric. He's a very worthwhile revisionist, and he's doing great work. He deserves a lot of credit and a lot of support.
Thanks very much.
Well, yes, he does. Okay, and thank you both very much for being here. I hope to talk to you both again. Good night, everyone.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.